Okay, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Welcome back to our study of the Augsburg Confession. We left off on page 54 at paragraph 13, and I don't know that there's any need to really get a running start into this. I think we can just pick up cold where we left off. This article is on monastic vows, article 27, and heretofore you've seen the emphasis on that latter word, vows. So there is a general critique of monasticism insofar as it pulls people out of society where God would have them vocationally connected and serving one another. There's some critique of those that, you know, under the auspices or pretenses of a spiritual life end up living a lazier and easier life. So that certainly is a kind of note that's hit here in this article. But as we've seen so far, the main criticism is on the vows, and particularly the vows to celibacy that are required, and very often were required of people before they were of age to make such serious vows. It's fascinating that the argument is based not only on scripture, but also on canon law, which, that's great. So you've got a Lutheran argument that's based in scripture and canon law, showing that the Roman Catholics have departed from this. Just one of the upside-down world things that we find is the innovators are the ones claiming to have the tradition on their side. Okay, so let's have our prayer. We'll jump back into this text. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.
Amen.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. Paragraph 13. So they made people believe that the profession of monasticism was far better than baptism, that the monastic life was more meritorious than that of rulers, pastors, and others who serve in their calling according to God's commands without any man-made services. None of these things can be denied. This is all found in their own books about monasticism. How did all this come about in monasteries? At one time, they were schools of theology and other branches of learning, producing pastors and bishops for the benefit of the church. Now it is another thing. It is needless to go over what everyone knows. Before, they came together for the sake of learning. Now, they claim that monasticism is a lifestyle instituted to merit grace and righteousness. They even preach that it is a state of perfection. They put monasticism far above all other kinds of life ordained by God. We have mentioned all these things without hateful exaggeration so that our teacher's doctrine on monasticism may be better understood. All right, and very clearly then here you can see the argument shift away from vows per se and into this idea that is contrary to the gospel, but even just contrary to the law, contrary to all things. Okay, so we'll pick back up on page 54, paragraph 18. First, concerning monks who marry, our teachers say that it is lawful for anyone who is not suited for the single life to enter into marriage. Monastic vows cannot destroy what God has commanded and ordained. God's commandment is this: because of the temptation to sexual immorality, each man should have his own wife. It is not just a command given by God. God has created and ordained marriage for those who are not given an exception to natural order by God's special work. This is what is taught according to the text in Genesis 2:18. It is not good that the man should be alone. Therefore, those who obey this command and ordinance of God do not sin. All right, so you can tell what the argument is. Celibacy is seen to be a unique gift that God bestows on some, but not on all. And in fact, the some seems to be a very small percentage of the total population. So if God's deeper law and order is that you feel lust, then you're not celibate, and so you should pursue marriage. That's the deeper order and law. But many at the time of this writing, obviously, had been forced into these vows of celibacy, having not been given the gift. And that, you know, results in and leads to disaster. All right, so, I mean, at least from our vantage point, I know this, like the monastery stuff still goes on, and there's celibacy as it relates to the pastoral office in the Roman Catholic Church, and there's, you know, different tangents and aberrations that continue to be extremely relevant today. But this article is very much occasioned by the specific circumstances going on at that time. All right, paragraph 22, go a little further. What objection can be raised to this? Let people praise the obligation of a monastic vow as much as they want, but they will never be able to destroy God's commandment by means of a monastic vow. Canon law teaches that superiors can make exceptions to monastic vows. How much less are such monastic vows enforced that are contrary to God's commands? If, in fact, an obligation to a monastic vow could never be changed for any reason, the Roman popes could never have granted exceptions to the vows. For it is not lawful for someone to make an exception to what is truly from God. The Roman pontiffs have wisely judged that mercy is to be observed in these monastic obligations. That is why we read that many times they have made special arrangements and exceptions with monastic vows. The case of King Aragon, who was called back from the monastery, is well known, and there are also examples in our own times. In the second place, why do our adversaries exaggerate the obligation or effect of a vow when at the same time they do not have anything to say about the nature of the vow itself? A vow should be something that is possible. It should be a decision that is made freely and after careful deliberation. We all know how possible perpetual chastity actually is in reality. And just how few people do take this vow freely and deliberately. Young women and men, before they are able to make their own decision about this, and obviously part of what's going on is the vows are made prepubescent. So it's like when boys think girls have cooties and vice versa, it's really easy to get a vow of chastity. But then when puberty hits, things change and they realize they're not given this gift, and what do you do? And so the Lutherans are here arguing, I mean, in a very Christian and pastoral way and in keeping even with the canon laws, we're seeing that they should be that these should be released from their vows. Okay, so I don't know. I find this argument all like par for the course, status quo. It's the way they've argued in all the articles. Maybe the interesting thing for us tangentially here in 27 is you do get a kind of positive theology of vows. So I know I spoke about that very briefly at some point, maybe last week, this idea of that you find in the scriptures of people taking vows. So here, just to review paragraph 27 and highlight some of these points where they say a vow should be something that is possible, okay? And it should be a decision that is made freely and after careful deliberation. So that's in no sense forbidding Christians from making vows. Instead, it's just offering three conditions under which vows should be made. Okay, let's pick up at 30. Therefore, it is not fair to insist so rigorously on the obligation. Everyone knows that taking a vow that is not made freely and deliberately is against the very nature of a true vow. Most canonical laws overturn vows made before the age of 15. Before that age, a person does not seem able to make a wise judgment and to decide to make a lifelong commitment like this. And I mean, just in passing, I'll say, that was at age 15. I feel like in our society, you have to wait till you're 45 until this would qualify. I mean, we created and produced perpetual children, unfortunately. So it really kind of shows a sickness. I mean, I don't know, maybe there's an argument to be made that 15 is too young to be making these life decisions or whatever, but sure does create a kind of collision with our modern understandings of these things. All right, 32. There is another canon law that adds even more years to this limit, showing that the vow of chastity should not be made before the age of 18. So which of these two canon laws should we follow? Most people leaving the monastery have a valid excuse, since they took their vows before they were 15 or 18. Finally, even though it might be possible to condemn a person who breaks a vow, it does not follow that it is right to dissolve such a person's marriage. Augustine denies that they ought to be dissolved. Augustine's authority should not be taken lightly, even though some wish to do so today. Although it appears that God's command about marriage delivers many from their vows, our teachers introduce another argument about vows to show that they are void. Every service of God established and chosen by people to merit justification and grace without God's commandment is wicked. For Christ says in Matthew 15:9, "In vain do they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men." Paul teaches everywhere that righteousness is not to be sought in self-chosen practices and acts of worship devised by people. Righteousness comes by faith to those who believe that they are received by God into grace for Christ's sake. All right, so you can see what's going on in this argument. It's that if they entered into the vow believing themselves to be meriting grace or the forgiveness of sins, and I don't know how much this kind of thing is romanticized today, maybe in some of our entertainment and movies it is, but just this idea of someone has committed a great sin or lived a sinful life, they'll, you know, throw themselves into the monastery in order to make up for it. This kind of, you know, dramatic type of thing. Well, the argument here is if they did so, then they can't be held to that vow because that vow is based on utterly false teaching, utterly false pretenses. We can't merit God's grace or favor. So if that's the vow you took in order to get that, the whole thing is null and void. That's the argument here in paragraphs 36 and 37. Okay, I've done quite a bit of reading. I mean, I just don't think there's a ton of deep theology here. I don't mean that in any offensive way. They're addressing a practical issue, and an issue is extremely important for their time, and they're making great arguments. But I'm just not, you know, finding a whole lot to comment on. Do you have any thoughts or anything you'd like to comment on or ask regarding what we've covered so far? Straightforward enough? Okay. So, paragraph 38. It is clear for all to see that the monks have taught that services made up by people make satisfaction for sins and merit grace and justification. What else is this than detracting from Christ's glory and hiding and denying the righteousness that comes through faith? Therefore, it follows that monastic vows, which have been widely taken, are wicked services of God, and consequently are void. Again, the idea is if they're done in order to make satisfaction for one's own sins. For a wicked vow taken against God's commandment is not valid. For as the canon says, no vow ought to bind people to wickedness. Paul says, "You are severed from Christ, you who would be justified by the law. You have fallen away from grace." Quoting Galatians 5:4 here. "Therefore, anyone wanting to be justified by his vows makes Christ useless and falls from grace. Anyone who tries to connect justification to monastic vows bases his justification on his own works, which properly belongs to Christ's glory. Okay, there's something important here to grasp, and that is, Paul says, justified by the law. That is, if you attempt to be justified by doing the deeds of the law, then you have forsaken Christ, because the law, even though it holds out the possibility for salvation, those who do it shall live by it, the fact is that no one does it. And the fact is that the law works this way, that if you're guilty of it in one place, as James says, you're guilty of breaking the whole thing. It's not something that's graded on a curve, or it's not something you can get mostly right. It's all or nothing when it comes to the law. So if it's nothing, and that's the great sweep of Romans, the first chapters of Romans up until 3 and 4, that's his whole point, is that no one keeps the law, but rather all who are under the law are silenced by the law before God and held accountable as sinners. So the argument here of the Lutherans is that if you can't even be justified by doing God's law, which is the highest law, then how much less could you be justified by doing man's law? You see the point? So the argument that you're not justified by the works of the law, and this taken like holistically, not by circumcision, not by observing the ceremonial laws in terms of diet or clothing or anything else, it's no part of the law. This is what God gave. And if you can't be justified by doing these works, how could you be justified by doing any other works? Is there another set of works that's superior to those that God gave on Sinai? So if you can't be justified by the greater, you can't be justified by the lesser. And of course, then, you can't be justified by things that are fabricated apart from the scriptures and brought in by the church. Not to say that the church can't create offices or institutions, different times and places that might be of service to her. That's perfectly free and perfectly allowed. We see examples of that in the first century church. But it's a very different thing than to say these institutions we've created, these positions and roles we've invented, now justify you before God. That's wild. That's a wild leap. So the Lutherans are on very solid ground here, and despite the sort of new perspective on Paul and the protests that, Luther's talking about, Galatians is talking specifically about the Judaizers and the circumcision and the ceremonial aspects of the law, and Luther misreads this, that's the accusation. Luther misreads this as talking about works in general. The fact of the matter is Luther doesn't misread it. He knows full and well what Paul is saying in context. It's simply an easy deduction and application to make when Luther says if Paul's argument is that you can't be justified by the very laws that God gave, then you can't be justified by any other works, especially those invented by the church later on. All right, so in a nutshell then, you see the Reformation here, and you see the proper understanding of Paul in Galatians and Romans, and then the proper application of this teaching in Luther's time, and obviously by extension in our own. Yes, sir.
I think there's another motivation also that we've discovered over the last 20, 30 years, and that is that persons that think that they've got some sort of deviancy, that they can join a monastery and pray real hard and it'll go away. And it doesn't happen that way. They infect everyone they're in contact with. And it's just gotten into a huge mess that they haven't done any screening for this stuff.
Yeah, it's difficult to comment just because monasticism varies so much over the centuries. But in some cases, monasteries even functioned as, I don't want to say exclusively, but in some times and places, it functioned almost like an insane asylum. Like, whereas in a larger Christian society, there were clearly people that didn't fit in with society, and so you'd say, off to the monastery with you, and at least they'd sort of be cordoned off, and to what degree they could be, led in productive lives, that seemed to be a way to do it. So, and I think maybe... maybe that impulse to go and do, I've got these huge problems, so I need a huge solution. I think sometimes that gets transferred to seminarians, and sometimes that's the root cause of why you see pastors have these great moral failings or fallings, and priests or whatever. I mean, where it's all the same office. So, and I'm not trying to be denomination specific here. But that is often the recipe of, I've got this major issue, I'm going to go try to get it solved at seminary and become a priest. And then it's like, it shows up in the middle of the ministry and it's a disaster for everyone. So, yeah, we just have to get rid of that thought entirely. And then maybe positively, the church has to just regain its sense that we're not just the house where you get forgiveness, but actually also a kind of house of healing. And that kind of idea of spiritual care and treatment and coming up with a plan and coming up with help to get people, off of the hang-ups they're hung up with, right? That gets diminished in 20th century Lutheranism and Protestantism for a lot of reasons. Consumerism and the business model of the church broadly, and then in gospel reductionism in our circles specifically, where it's like, the only thing the church has for me is just the words, you are forgiven, and nothing else. So then I'm just stuck in this perpetual cycle, and then just kind of hanging on by a lifeline of just hearing I'm forgiven with nothing else. So that causes people to think in ways of like, well, how could I? What could I do to go get healed or find help? And very often that's outside of the things that Christ has given. So anyway, sorry for my verbose answer, but kind of brought those things to mind, yeah. Was there another hand? I see another comment. Okay. We'll jump back in the text. Did we leave off at 38, is that right? I'm sorry, what, where? Oh, did we? Oh, we got way further, sorry. 44 then? Is that the new? Okay. Maybe I cut off mid-paragraph there, 41 to 43. So just picking up at 43, anyone who tries to connect justification to monastic vows bases his justification on his own works, which properly belongs to Christ's glory. So you can see that justification is apart from works. I mean, that should be self-evident in Paul. But the faith that justifies itself works in love. And the faith that justifies does indeed love and produce works of love. It's just that this isn't counted as part of justification. If it were, then justification becomes uncertain and conditional and not a matter of grace. So this wonderful Pauline insight into the gospel is, of course, still needed in the church today. Paragraph 44. It cannot be denied that the monks have taught that they were justified and merited the forgiveness of sins by means of their vows and observances. And that's kind of what's in the backdrop of it being greater than baptism, because you had a baptism, but you still fell into all these sins. So now if you go into monasticism, you're going to be making satisfaction for these sins. And so I'm not saying any of this is terribly logical, but there's a kind of twisted or perverse rationality to it as the system is set up, and then as you can see baptism as one thing, and it was obviously insufficient, the argument would go, and now you're a monastic, and so you're making up for it, so monasticism is greater than baptism. I mean, it's perverse, but that's the kind of rationale that the Lutherans are trying to attack and undermine, rightly so, on biblical principles. Right, so 44, it cannot be denied that the monks have taught that they were justified and merited forgiveness of sins by means of their vows and observances. Indeed, they even invented greater absurdities, saying that they could give others a share in their works. So this is the whole treasury of the saints, the treasury of merit. It's just one of the most absurd things ever, that there's Christians that are so good that they not only perfectly fulfill the Ten Commandments and or do enough good works to make up for, to have more credits than debits, but that they've been so obedient not only in these things, but in the monastic order and rules that have been put upon them, that they've got all of this extra merit lying around. And then so when they die, what happens to all of that credit? Well, since God is just, it just sits up in some sort of moral bank in heaven until he distributes it. I mean, the whole idea is just wildly absurd. It's hard to look at the medieval church and think it didn't need a reformation. It most certainly does. And of course, the Roman church today is just, I mean, I respect Roman Catholic individuals. I'm sure they're pious and they love Christ and want to do what's right. But the Roman Catholic magisterium, the papacy, that's even worse. I mean, it's hard to even critique it, like on theological grounds per se, because, or classically theological grounds, because it's so off the rails into politics and abominations and subverting its own rich heritage that, I mean, you just look at it and you go, institutionally, it doesn't need to be reformed. It needs to be leveled and started brand new. There's no other way to save Roman Catholicism than that. Like, you're not going to have another council that sets things right. That's way too late in the day for that. I don't know. Maybe that's good news, because Christ is going to come. I mean, that's the alternative, that Christ will just have to come and set these things right himself. Okay, I think we left off around 45. If anyone wanted to make more of this point, to make our opponents look even worse, even more things could be mentioned, things that even the monks are ashamed of now. And on top of all this, the monks persuaded people that the services that they invented were a state of Christian perfection. What else is this other than assigning our justification to works? It is no light offense in the church to be to set before the people a service invented by people without God's command, and then to teach them that such service justifies. For the righteousness of faith, which ought to be the highest teaching in the church, is hidden when these quote-unquote wonderful and angelic forms of worship, with their show of poverty, humility, and celibacy, are put in front of people. Yeah, so, I mean, you see the perverse nature of this, like, even from, like, like just a twisted, almost cult-like way that that people within the church designed this, so that poverty is set up as this completely meritorious thing in this perfect life, which, so if you're going to take a vow of poverty, who's likely to benefit from you offloading all your possessions? Usually, explicitly, the monastery itself and or the church. Likewise, you know, and as if possessing property is somehow inherently inferior. That's simply not the case. I mean, the apostles possess property of one kind or another up until the end. I'm not really talking about real estate, although that may well be true. But even just general cloak, sword, whatever else they might have. Okay, so you've got poverty, this kind of thing. And then humility, which often took on the form, these vows of obedience, which are wild. They're still around today, where you completely relinquish your own will and transfer it to your superior within the monastery. And this is, I mean, goodness, could you like paint a better set of circumstances where abuses can take place? When you completely let go of your own and just do whatever you're told always, and even unto like things that start like this slippery slope of degradation all the way down into just gross immorality. These vows of, I mean, and this is why the Lutherans are critical of it, because it's this show of like great superiority of after other Christians when the whole thing is really quite corrupt on every level. And then, of course, celibacy has been in view this whole time, so no need to beat on that. All right, 49. God's precepts and God's true service are hidden when people hear that only monks are in a state of perfection. True Christian perfection is to fear God from the heart, to have great faith, and to trust that for Christ's sake we have a God who has been reconciled. It means to ask for and expect from God his help in all things, with confident assurance that we are to live according to our calling in life, being diligent in outward good works, serving in our calling. This is where true perfection and true service of God is to be found. It does not consist in celibacy or in begging or in degrading clothes. So this paragraph is worth spending some time on, because if you want, this is a simple way to think about it. Our catechism with the explanation does a good job on this. Like, if the question is, what is justification? That's a different question than what is Christianity. So what is justification? Justification is the central or core part of Christianity, but they're not identical to each other. Justification is the gracious forgiveness of sins on account of Christ's atoning death that is received by faith. That's justification. And that's laid out for us, obviously, in paragraph 41 through 43 and beyond. But the question of what is the Christian life, or what is true Christian perfection, that expands outward into vocation and works as well. So what is justification? It's this narrow doctrine compared to what is Christianity. It's the narrow doctrine of justification with the other stuff added to it. So again, I'll just let you read it right from the source itself here. That third line of paragraph 49, true Christian perfection is to fear God from the heart. Are those of you who are in the men's study, you're also like, it probably just sounds like this to your ears, how close this is to how Luther sounds in the first commandment. To fear God from the heart, to have great faith, and to trust that for Christ's sake, we have a God who has been reconciled. So you have fear, faith, and trust, all described here in overlapping ways. To fear God from the heart, to have great faith. Like, these are the things we want to aspire toward. These are the things we want to have within ourselves. And to trust that for Christ's sake, we have a God who has been reconciled. Very similar now to the second commandment in Luther's Large Catechism. It means to ask for and expect from God his help in all things, with confident assurance that we are to live according to our calling in life. There's the idea of vocation or calling that God calls us to specific roles within life. And I think the danger today is that people think of this in too specific of a term. Like, they think of it concretely as like, well, I'm working as an accountant. That's God's calling. I can't do anything other than be an accountant. Or I'm working as a lawyer, or I'm working at Home Depot, or I'm a janitor, or I'm a doctor. I can't do other because that's God's calling for my life. That's a misunderstanding of the biblical doctrine of vocation. That's not what's meant. Vocation, biblically speaking, is that you are called into the three estates. So you'll recognize this from the Table of Duties and from the Pauline Haustafel texts. But you are either, in the state of the family, you are born into the world as a child. That's a vocation. That's what that means. So you have a duty unto your parents, right? Parents have a duty unto their children. The precondition, biblically, for having children is to be married. And so here you are a husband or a wife, and you have a duty one unto the other, and they're not completely symmetrical. They're asymmetrical duties. And then part of that duty as a husband is to provide for your household. And again, in our modern times, like, this is difficult, and it's not one size fits all, and it's maybe not how it should be, but we have to navigate it. And I don't fault Christian men who, if they and their wife decide, we both need to work, or one or the other of us has to work, and women get paid way better than men. I mean, that's how upside down our society is. Then that's the decision and choice we're going to make to order our home in that way. I don't fault that. I just think we need to understand that that's kind of an extraordinary circumstance in which we find ourselves. It's like when the people of Judah were exiled up into Babylon, they found themselves in extraordinary circumstances. And God tells the prophets even, hey, I know this is like outside of the norm, and there's different norms and mores here in Babylon, but you have to get used to it because you're going to be here until, I don't know what it was, 40 years or something like that. So that's how we find ourselves in the Babylon of this world, is we have to pay attention to how society is actually functioning and then try to navigate that, even while we don't lose sight of the ideal and the structure. All right, so in that sense, then, your job as a husband would be to be a provider. Your job as a wife would be to be a mother. You can't let anything interfere with that, strictly speaking. So then that opens the door for you as a man to work any job. Your vocation is to be a husband who provides and protects. It's not also made illegal or immoral by the scriptures that women would work outside of the home, as long as the primary responsibility remains the rearing of children. That's what the Bible gives, to be specifically to be lovers of husbands and lovers of their children. That's how it's explained by Paul and Titus. Okay, so that gets us to understanding like vocation, and then how that extends out into employers and employees, to use our modern terminology. And then we find ourselves vocationally situated by God as either those who govern or those who are governed in the left-hand kingdom, the estate of the state, those who are tasked with the teaching office in the church, and those who are hearing the teaching, those two offices within the estate of the church. So you've got those three estates, and that's what's meant by vocation or calling in life, and then to live within those specific callings according to the Ten Commandments. Okay, so I know I'm off on a tangent here talking about this phrase, our calling in life, but that's the shape and form then of being diligent. I'm just the sentence right before paragraph 50, of being diligent in outward good works, serving in our calling. This is where true perfection and true service of God is to be found. So what you see again, to zoom all the way back out and return to the original distinction and the original point I'm trying to make, is you see that justification is a part of this. It is a center of this. Namely, the rest is predicated upon it. True Christian perfection is fear of God from the heart, to have great faith and to trust that. I mean, so all of the fear and faith and trust is predicated on what he's done for us in Christ Jesus. And that we have a God who has reconciled us for Christ's sake, not through our works. So justification is, if you like, the foundation, if you like, the center. It's the key thing, but it's not the only thing. So what follows then is prayer and vocational living, good works according to the commandments of God. That is all considered together the Christian life, or to use the language here, that is altogether considered the Christian perfection. So you can see then that a great distortion takes place when we ask the question, what is Christianity, or what is the Christian life? And the answer given is justification. That's a huge distortion. What is justification? Justification. What is Christianity? What is the Christian life? Justification plus all the other stuff God would have for us. Right? The Christian life is broader than mere justification. And again, the explanation of the small catechism bears this out, as does the Augsburg Confession, the rest of the confessional documents. But here, this paragraph is really worth kind of taking in and letting it shape and form your theology if you want to be biblical and you want to be truly Lutheran. Okay, any thoughts? Anyone want to offer any comments or observances, observations?
Pastor, I know we've sort of skimmed by celibacy already, but I kind of wonder if this doesn't stem back to the perpetual virginity of Mary, Because if Mary was perpetually a virgin, then it follows that Joseph had to be celibate. And not because, presumably not because Mary just kept saying, no, I've got a headache, but because he took some kind of vow of celibacy. And so I kind of wonder if we're not supposed to, like, we're supposed to look at Joseph as some kind of paragon of virtue that we follow.
Yeah, it's a little bit, I mean, I would say that it's a little bit chicken and egg how these doctrines become so important. You know, do they recognize, like, and just work with me here, right? A, that Mary is perpetually virgin, and then Joseph is celibate, and that helps to heighten and amplify the push towards virginity that really gets kind of unbounded at later centuries in the church? Or is it this idea of virginity itself that gets elevated, and then the data of Mary and Joseph kind of gets shoved in that as a proof? I don't know. There's a kind of chicken
and egg.
Could be
some kind of a feedback too. You know, one keeps feeding on the other. But it seems to me it's probably just not true that Mary was perpetually a virgin. I think those things where we say Jesus has half brothers or brothers of Jesus, I think he really did have brothers.
Yeah, that's fair enough. I mean, so I just, for the sake of everyone here in the broader, we do have people who listen to us online. That's encouraging. But for their sake as well, it is left as an open question in theology, which is, that has a technical sense, that you're allowed to think she was perpetually a virgin or you're allowed to think that she was not. And we're not going to condemn each other. We're not going to divide over that. You did a fine job giving the data that's used for the fact that she was certainly a virgin through the birth, but then that virginity gave way at some point to Joseph and to natural affection. And I don't find that kind of teaching like noxious or heretical or anything like that. I think it's a reasonable conclusion. It is worth pointing out on the other side of the coin that Christians up until the 20th century believed in her perpetual virginity. Even Luther and Calvin, and basically any Lutheran of substance and name up until the 20th century thinks that. So that's worth pausing. That's worth considering. The Book of Concord does refer to her as the perpetually virgin Mary. Now, not in a doctrinally binding way. I think that's relatively clear for all of us. That phrase. That seems to be the most, well, there's a couple of things where it talks about Jesus' brothers, that Adelphoi word.